Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast, where we bring together leaders in tech from all across the globe to help us grow our businesses. My name is Gary Lafty, the CEO and founder of Growth Focus Partnerships, where we generate revenue and drive revenue for tech companies by turning leaders in tech from just another expert into authorities and key persons of interest. Now, enough about that, but this week I have the honor of having Jeffrey Chalmers from Sight Machine, and we'll be talking all things finance, because when we run a company, it can't just be product and it can't just be service. The finance is the important part of the cog as well. So we'll be talking things like cash flow mastery, we'll be talking about scenario planning and the importance of that, team, getting the right team on board, and much, much more, including VC's expectations versus company expectations. So without further ado, Jeff, it's great having you here. It's an absolute honor. Why don't we start by kicking off? Why don't you give us a little bit about your background and your pathway to where you are today?
Well, thanks, Gary. Good to be here. So my name's Jeff Chalmers. I'm the VP Finance and Operations at Sight Machine. I've been here for 5 years. Started my career in public accounting at PwC for about a dozen years. And then sort of wound my way through a variety of public and private companies as controller, VP controller, working my way up. So a lot of companies that have been smaller, startups, some public companies, you know, always interesting dealing with the public company side of the business. But my passion is really startups and taking them and helping them to become more profitable and more efficient in their operations.
Brilliant, brilliant. And yes, this is the question I really want to ask you straight off the bat, you know, because there'll be people listening here and going, you know, I can always put that to the side. I can always put to the finance to the side. But, you know, CFOs, VP of finance, head of finances often work behind the scenes when it comes to growing a company. So how do you see your role contributing to the growth and the long-term success of a company, especially a startup?
Yeah, it's interesting, Gary. I know when I was starting my career, somewhere along the way, someone said that a CFO needs to know two things, their cap table and their cash. And that's always stuck with me. So, you know, in the role of finance, especially in a startup when you're not profitable yet, I mean, cash is king. So you have to absolutely manage your cash critically, understand where it is, understand what's coming in, what investors might invest, and where the company is and how the company might, manage their cash, what they can and cannot afford. I mean, of course, everyone always wants to spend more money. You'd love to spend the money, but you've got to also make sure that you're balancing those cash versus the revenues. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is the, and I'm glad you said that, because yes, it's always, especially when we're going to talk about VCs a little bit later on, but there is this tendency to chuck a lot of money at things really just to get the ball rolling. And this is a good thing. It does sound like sometimes, but there's been so many times we've come across companies that have overspent, they've lent over their skis far too much and actually come a cropper. So what insights can you share with us about that delicate balance between company growth and being fiscally responsible?
Yeah, it is a delicate balance. And I'll tell you personally, early last year, we found ourselves in that same position at Sight Machine. But it is really about trying to figure out what you want to invest in and then make those investments, but not make them, not get too much, as you said, over the skis. So taking a look, your biggest investments are generally in people, and so finding out, you know how you hire people, when you bring them on, even to the extent, quite frankly, when you think about recruiting. I mean, you can't turn the switch and say, okay, I'm going to add a new person in January, and then in February they're going to start selling, or in February they're going to start coding, or in February they're going to start marketing or doing whatever. So you have to, the recruiting cycle is sometimes longer, you know, 2-3 months. The onboarding cycle is also not that fast. You know, bring them on, takes them 2-3 months to get up to speed. So it is a delicate balance about what you think you're going to need, probably in 6 months, and green light that right now. But then also be very careful about not getting, not getting too much ahead of where the spending is.
Yeah, I think that's going to be certainly a fear for some of the people that were listening here today. They're going to think, well, I've been down that road before. I've ended up having consultants on the bench. We saw a big upturn. The upturn didn't really happen. Or now we've gone past that initial stage. And now we have costs where we have consultants on the bench not producing any revenue anymore. How does one plan for that? It's certainly things we don't expect, like a COVID happening or things like that. What's the best way to deal with things like that?
Yeah. Experience. I don't know what else to say. Every 2 years ago, we had a CFO and we did this detailed planning analysis. And we met with everyone in the team and what do they all say? I need, this one needs a few people. This one needs a few people. This one needs a few people. And then, all of a sudden you find that, you need another 20 or 30% in the company. Well, that's great. But why do they need it? Probably because the sales guys are saying, we're going to double our revenue. Well, the double the revenue is more difficult. So then how do you scale that up? How do you decide, okay, what are the most critical? What can you do? And then not to be scared to say, listen, I said yes, but the revenue is just not coming in the way it should. So we're going to have to, cut those heads. And quite frankly, probably my biggest project on my weekly meeting is with our recruiting person. And we have a very, very candid discussion. And I will give them instructions and say, hey, this one we're gathering resumes. This position we need to hire more immediately. So it's a very, very interesting balance of where we are. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, staffing is always an issue. And one of the tendencies, I know you and I have spoken about this before, but there's a tendency to say, rather than let's have employees on the bench in whatever role, whether it be marketing, whether it be sales, or whether it be engineering or coding, there's a tendency for some companies to take the easy, more relaxed option of taking consultants, of getting consultants on board.
Yeah.
But they have dangers as well, right? Why don't we talk about that for a little bit?
Yes, no, you're 100% right. We have a lot of consultants, mainly offshore consultants that are very, very valuable to the company. They do a lot of work. The question is, do we treat them as consultants or do we treat them as employees? And from an employee perspective, every year people get evaluated. If you're not performing, we need to switch you out. So we have to manage. We have to manage that. More recently, I had someone come to me in the U.S. and say, "I need to hire this consultant." And I looked and said, "Well, what are you trying to do?" And they said, "Well, we think we've got some extra, extra requirements in some technical area." And I said, fine, so we're going to bring in a consultant versus an employee. Have you thought about that consultant? Have you interviewed them for the cultural fit for the company? What if they don't work out? It's 3 months of expensive people that have to get up to speed and get working. So for us, for me, that was interesting. And as I discussed it with them, first of all, they hadn't done the cultural interview, which was disappointing. And then as we thought a little bit more, I said, that's probably more a full-time employee than a consultant. You're going to take these people with you to clients. You're going to want them to manage stuff. So we have to make sure that they consider themselves an employee. I mean, you're going to go out to a big company and you're going to bring someone along that may not have the business card, that doesn't really look the same as everyone else. And so, It's interesting that sometimes that happens. It's also in my I don't think people are doing it intentionally, but it's a way to go around getting a headcount. So it's really interesting. In our company, I'm not sure how other companies do this. The technical screens are just amazing. I mean, we have 1 in 5 people pass our technical screens, and so to get someone into the company, just even past the technical screens, it's you know, it's an act of God. And so you bring them in. They pass all the technical screens, and then we have to get them through the cultural screens, which are even more important. And sometimes you get people through both, and then we do the, you know, the interview, reference checks, and you'll find they got a bad reference check. I mean, it's just amazing how difficult it is. You know, the amount of time it takes to bring people in, to qualify them, to get them through cultural fits, to get them through everything. It's really difficult. And so we have to be so careful about how we invest our time and valuable resources.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just listening to you here, and there's people probably, you know, going to be listening and go, wow, what a process to get things through. But it's almost a good thing, unless you have an SOP for it, unless you actually know what the actual interview, hiring, recruitment process is, you can't then really reverse engineer it and see how long it's actually going to take you. But more importantly, it really sounds like because you have these SOPs in place and this whole procedure, and we're going to talk, I want to talk a little bit about these tests in a minute, but you have these procedures, but it also means that you're avoiding the knee-jerk reaction, and you're just avoiding that, oh gosh, I suddenly need people and I've got to get somebody really, really quickly, and then you're really bringing on the wrong person. So you talked about certain tests. Obviously, the technical is self-explanatory. So let's talk a little bit about this cultural testing that you've mentioned a couple of times. Why don't you share a little bit of insights about what that is and why is that important?
Yeah. So, so our company is a big educational type company internally. We read books and study. Our favorite author is Pat Lencioni from the Table Group, and he has a book called The Ideal Team Player. And we'll leverage those attributes: hungry, humble, smart. And through the interviews, especially on the services and the engineering team, which are two biggest teams, what they'll do is they'll obviously have the core technical testing, and then they'll do some online screening that they have. But the interviewers are given, you know, list of questions from this book, Hungry, Humble, Smart, and told to focus on those parts of it. Because what we've seen is you bring in someone that's brilliant, that's absolutely, you know, fantastic technically, but if they cannot work with the rest of the team, the disruption is just unbelievable. You know, and you've got, you know, a third of the company in engineering, and they're trying to get their work done, and you've got some guy that's, you know, trying to drag you in a different direction because he thinks this is what he needs to do, and he just doesn't understand how to do this, frustrates the rest of the team. And quite frankly, that's often the most turnover in the company. It's not because people can't do the work, it's because they just can't work with the rest of the team.
That's fascinating. That is absolutely fascinating just hearing you say that. Yeah. And actually, when you think about it, you're absolutely right. We just don't see that. We sometimes think it is purely about their inability or their inability to actually do the work itself. But actually, it's about their attitude, how they do it. And that's what I said. I love the fact of hiring for attitude as opposed to just for aptitude, you know, because when you're looking at team, it is so important, and you don't want that rotten apple. And although it sounds so simple, It's a problem that most companies don't even see. They just think we just need the skill set in there. We need the aptitude, and that they forget and thinking the attitude will come. It will be molded, you know.
Yeah,
and that's one of the biggest challenges of it. So let's talk about long term vision with teams. And so, you know, if we get the right person in, you're almost like creating a great foundation for long term growth as opposed to short term gain. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's the vision, right? You want to bring in these high producing teams, high effective teams. You know, we still struggle. There's a book over here called Influencer. I don't know if you've heard or read it, but we're starting to study that. I mean, just how do you create the right behaviors? And so if you look at some of the successful professional organizations, whether it be accounting firms or law firms or even consulting firms, you know, they bring in these junior people right out of college, and within a year, maybe even less, you know, they start to get turned into these chiseled, hardened, you know, professionals. And it's because the culture just oozes out of the walls. You know, they didn't know in the beginning what they needed to do, but there is just some massive cultural changes that force them to do that. And the ones that don't work are voted off the island. You know, they're let go pretty quickly. But if we can do the same thing, that would be fantastic. You know, and it just takes literally one or two people with a different type of energy to help. To make that company a little better. I'll tell you an interesting story. Last year, end of last year, we decided we're in a building in San Francisco, a very, very nice building. It was an old printing house, and it has a huge sort of atrium underneath, and then upstairs there's some desks. And we were divided between the upstairs and the downstairs. And because of the number of people that come in the office, you know, it wasn't fully utilized. So I think, you know, just around about the break last year, we moved everyone downstairs. And so everyone is literally sitting next to each other. We've got, I wouldn't even say pods, because we've got rows of desks. But I can just feel that the energy is different. And you think about it, it's a very, very small thing that we did. Just moving people around a little bit, bringing some whiteboards, getting more collaboration. The back to office is interesting on the hybrid side, and if you want, we can dive into that. But you know, how do you just bring the team a little bit together, get them talking to each other, because we're so used to these Zoom calls and, you know, sitting at home and working away, and it's fascinating how you just find, you know, meld these teams together.
Yeah, that really is, like you say, it's a fascinating concept. And concept's not really the right word, but the thing is, yeah, I'm a great believer in where appropriate, back to work, you know, because we're not getting the collaboration. This is the reason why this podcast is where it is, because it's about bringing people and leaders together so we can collaborate rather than just having meetings after meetings after meetings about, you know, so where we can actually learn from each other. And if it's just you can get one nugget from one person that can make that one person or that one task better, then the whole company gets better at doing it. And I love what you said earlier, you know, it just, if you get it right and you go into these companies, you can actually see it oozing from the walls, like you said. The atmosphere just changes, you know. It's a fascinating thing. So that being said, I want to shift a little bit and talk about VCs, you know, because again, like everything in finance, there's always and entrepreneurship and growing a business, there's pros and cons of everything, you know. And again, when it comes to VCs, VCs can be an absolute savior for the company. They can be an absolute fantastic stepping stone, but they can also be the death of you if one's following their detached mentality towards growing that company. And you and I talked about this fantastic concept before, which is the run fast and then conserve. You know, they have this attitude. They say, right, we've got to go run really fast and get these things, and then we need to conserve it. Let's talk about that, because this is something which people don't talk about when it comes to VCs. And there'd be people out there listening thinking, oh, I'm going through the same thing with the VCs. I didn't realize that was a thing. Or you better be aware of this when you start dealing with VCs. So let's talk about this challenge of run fast and conserve.
Yeah. No, I call it the fear and greed. You know, it's so funny, and I'll tell you a quick story. My first job out of Pricewaterhouse was I joined a company, and the day after I joined, we started the IPO process. And as we got towards the end, they were, you know, we're trying to find out if the VCs wanted to sell their shares or they wanted to buy more. And it was interesting. So these were VCs. This was a young company had been going for 2 years, so this was a great exit for the VCs. And they literally said, if the price is, you know, is the high end of the range, well, we want to sell. And if it's a low end of the range, we want to buy. And this is, you know, how the VCs are, right? It's the fear and greed, right? You know, if they think you're going to run out of cash, you know, cut heads, cut expenses, do whatever. And the minute that you have one good quarter or some good results, it's like, come, let's invest. Let's just go fast. Because if we do more, we're going to grow a lot. And as a finance leader, you have to be a little bit more stable. So you can't deal with that volatility. So you have to try to figure out what's the best approach. And sometimes even on the boards, which is really the VC investors, you've got some that are conserve, grow steadily, and some that are let's just spend all our money and grow fast. But that's like, you know, going to Las Vegas. And if it doesn't work out, then what happens? You know, you still got, you know, people, you've got payroll to make, you've got expenses to pay and so on. So if we want to transition a little bit, what I found very helpful is doing the scenario planning. So to say, okay, so here's where we are today. What if we grow 50%? What will that look like? How much money will we spend? What revenue will we get? How much heads should, you know, will we add, and where will we end up? And what if we don't do anything or do very, very little, you know, stuff that's more, you know, 90% certain? Where does that take us? And I think when you do the scenario planning, if you have a good CEO, and I have a fantastic CEO who's a lawyer, Wharton MBA, and a bunch of business experience, where you can just discuss and you can sort of flip between the scenarios fairly easily. You know, this is the growth scenario, this is the conserved cash scenario. You really know where you are. And so as you're doing your periodic updates, you say, yeah, it looks like we're going back to the conserved cash scenario. And if you can give those tickler points to them, they're speaking to the VCs often. And even when you're speaking to VCs, it's interesting. If you indicate that things are going great, all of a sudden, as we discussed, it's like, let's go fast, you know, versus if you have one tough quarter, but maybe there's a bunch of business that's getting ready to close and you feel very comfortable. It's like, well, should you be cutting heads? Should you be cutting expenses? And as an operations person, you really don't have that luxury of changing. As you know, we spoke about earlier in the podcast, it takes a long time to hire and bring people on board. So as you're cutting heads, you have to be very, very careful, because to replace them is not easy.
No, absolutely. And I think it's vital. And this is if there's one key message people take away from this episode, is that VCs sound really, really great, you know, but you can just be a number. If you have the attitude that you are just another clog in their machine, and really, quite frankly, although you think they care about you, they're just looking at the numbers. And like you said, if the numbers aren't if it's not in the green, you're cutting. You know, and you get into red because you've had one bad conversation, you said the wrong thing, you're suddenly in the red and something's happening again. You know, so you've got to be very, very careful about the reporting. And we're not saying like misreport, but just be slightly cleverer about how you're saying and know what the consequences are when dealing with VCs and the reporting side.
Yeah. Gary, you know, VCs, I mean, these guys, you know, come from, you know, most of them have good pedigrees, good business schools and that. And sometimes, you know, not sometimes, often they'll tell you stuff that you didn't really focus on. And it's good to listen to them. Agree with you. You know, it's really how you communicate with them and be respectful. I mean, they see a lot of different companies. And if you find the VCs that understand your business and really know what's going on in the industry, upstream or downstream, it can be very valuable. And so it's really a case of making, you know, understanding where the VC is coming from, what they're doing, and how you can best leverage them. If you go back a few steps, as you're raising money, what's probably more important is which VCs you choose to do business with. This is not the charm school, right? It's like, really, you know, who are your other portfolio companies? What have you done? How do you help them? And you're really looking for people that can help you, that can advise you, that can guide you. And I will tell you, the more recent investors in our company are incredibly helpful to us. I mean, I sit in on some of the board meetings and hear the discussions. And if you have those type of people that are around you, it can really help your company be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with that. It's absolutely finding the right VC that's there to help you grow, yes, as opposed to just adding to their portfolio, because that's what they're looking for, is growth. And if you can find that right one, and one that might, and this is something which, you know, we come up a lot with people, is potentially the term overvaluation. You know, they're overvaluing a company, and although it feeds the ego of the founder and the CEO, it's not necessarily a good thing when it comes down to running your business. So that being said, Jeff, I want to really ask your advice on this one. What do you believe then, irrespective of bootstrap, irrespective of VC work, irrespective of growth, what do you think are the key financial metrics you believe every founder and every CEO should track closely, and why?
As I said earlier on, you know, definitely your cap table and your cash are the two. You know, if you don't know, you know, what your cap table is, I mean, today there's tools and technologies, you can get real time cap tables. You know, I'm old enough that I can remember where you know you would have spreadsheets and you would write down, and you know, what's the fully diluted, you know, who gets this, that, the other. So cap table is critical as you're talking to VCs and investors. They want to know what the shares are, if they invest, how much they'll get, and you know, cash is the other one. Now, cash then breaks down into sort of two buckets: spending and revenue. So if you know what your cash is, what your forecast is. You know, the expenses you can manage reasonably well. I mean, in our business, it's really headcount is the main driver of that. And then it's revenue. So what revenue do you have? When is it coming in? How much cash does it generate? And from that, you know, you'll come up to metrics. In our business, we're sort of a SaaS company, although we're now branding ourselves towards more of an AI, but ARR is the key metric, annual recurring revenue. So that's the key one. And then right underneath that is something called net recurring revenue, net revenue retention, which is really how much growth you get from your existing customers. Yeah. So if someone comes in today and buys a dollar, in a year's time, will they buy, you know, $1.03, $1.05, $1.10, and anything over 1.1 is very valuable. So those are the key drivers in my mind of what you have to be, you know, careful and watch like a hawk.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. So I've got one more question for you, Jeff. I mean, it's been fantastic having you here, and that, you know, given all of your experience of, you know, from your PwC day to where you are today, if you could give your younger self or an aspiring CFO or an aspiring CEO of a tech company one piece of advice, what would it be?
Transparency. So most people are pretty smart. They know what they're doing. They know where everything is. The concept of, you know, oh, it looks like my cash might be a little bit low. What am I going to do? You know, I'm going to hide it. I'm going to do something. Transparency is so critical. You know, telling the CEO, letting the rest of the leadership team know, so that they don't have a different understanding than you do. So it's hard for you to admit that, to be a little bit vulnerable. Say, hey, it looks like we tied on cash. And everyone knows then that as people are coming to them and say, can I do this? Can I do that? They have to be much more careful about how they do things, and whether it's cash or revenue or where things are. But just that transparency and vulnerability, I think, is very, very critical.
Well, I think that's an absolute vital piece of advice. Yeah. You know, thank you. As a transparency, but just being, like you said, the humbleness of it, the being the vulnerable part of it,
right,
but getting that out right at the right time can really help dividends down the road, really help you down the road.
Yep.
So thank you very much. So Jeff, thank you. And listen, it's been an absolute honor having you here and sharing your insights and sharing your expertise. It's been an absolute pleasure as well. And I just want to thank you for coming and sharing your time with us today.
Well, thank you, Gary. It's good to spend time with you. Great questions, and hopefully people can get some value out of this podcast.
I'm sure they will. And on that note, thank you guys very much for joining us from today. Now, if you've got any insights, which I'm sure you have, from Jeff today, please make sure that you utilize them. Otherwise, we all know that knowledge is not power unless you actually take action on that knowledge. So if you've learned something today, please make sure you put it in the comments, make sure you like, and more importantly, make sure you subscribe. But as always, please make sure you share this information with people that we know so that we can all grow in our business. So until next time, thank you very much for joining us on this episode. Thank you again, Jeff. Until next time, we'll see you all soon. Bye-bye.